Blog Talk Radio.
Country, and I can hear outside of my home somebody trying to dig himself out to pull out the car. Well, oh, goodness gracious, but it's, thank goodness it's cozy inside here. Well, this is in honor of Black History Month. We have found somebody named George Solano who actually encountered a long-lost movie that he was involved in. And so I'm going to put him on right now to talk about it. George, how are you?
Well, good. How do you do? It's a nice sunny day, but there's still a lot of ice out here in the Hamptons, so I'm stuck indoors for today.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so am I. It's okay.
So anyway, everything went well at the presentation on Tuesday at Queens College.
Mm-hmm.
I was
tell
very
us
pleased with
yeah.
how it went, and it was good to meet you there as well.
Well, George, first introduce yourself to my audience.
Well, my name is George Solano, and I'm a retired motion picture cameraman director. And my whole adult life has been spent making motion pictures of various types, like documentaries, TV commercials, and feature films, and industrial films, fashion films. The interesting thing about being in the movie business in that area of cameraman or cameraman director is that it's always a freelance work, so that what happens is you spend your life like a movie actor in a certain sense, where you're home waiting for the phone to ring. And every time the phone does ring, it's a completely different assignment. So it was I've been blessed with the kind of excitement where every time the phone rang, it was a different kind of project to get involved with. And
well, before we get into the projects that that you get involved with, I want to get into Tuesday night's event.
Right. Well, that was a interesting story because with Martin Luther King, I was called out of the blue in December of 65. I got this another phone call, and it was from a man I didn't really know too well because he was not active in the motion picture area, but his name was Arnold Michaelis, and he was a very famous interviewer, but mostly on radio. So he had, when he passed away, he left 600 hours of interviews with major heads of states of the world and major movie stars. And he was a very intelligent and cultured man, and he called me and he said, "George, I've got permission to go down to Atlanta to Martin Luther King's house to do an interview with him, and I wondered if you could help me out on it." So I was honored to be thought of, and so I said, "Of course." So Arnold was going to do this with no affiliation with major networks. He was using his own money to finance the project. So we had sort of a modest kind of crew, you know, with a basic director, cameraman, and my assistant, and my sound man, and that was it. And we all flew down to Atlanta, and we stayed at a hotel and went over and met with Martin Luther and Coretta King at their home, and they allowed us as much time as we needed. So we had one camera only because it was a low budget, and we spent 3 or 4 days in his house with Arnold interviewing Martin Luther King and me doing my job of you know, recording it. So my responsibility was to make sure we created the illusion that there were three cameras instead of one. As you can imagine, when you're shooting two people in an interview, you can only be on one person at one time. So it was kind of a nice challenge for me, and I like that sort of challenge. And so we covered, you know, Arnold covered most of the main thoughts of Dr. King, and we did some nice work with Coretta as well, who I don't think ever spoke on camera about some of the intimate subjects that she talked about, such as when their home was bombed in 1956. I don't think anyone's ever heard her speak about that. And it was like sort of a turning point in their life. They just had a six-month-old, their first child was 6 months old at the time, and the house was bombed. And Martin was out of town at the time, and he rushed back the next day or over, you know, within overnight, and it was really a serious event, as you can imagine. If your home was bombed, I could imagine that they would say, you know something, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. But on the contrary, it made them more determined than ever to pursue what they were doing, you know, to get some kind of a fair adjustment to their racism, especially down in Alabama. You can imagine the Deep South, what was going on down there. So we came away with that, you know, many cans of film. I shot it in 16mm black and white.
Right.
And being a freelancer, I disappeared into the realm of the motion picture world, where Arnold, the producer, was left with that film. We went back to New York, and he had it developed, and I never really found out much about what he was doing with it, how he was editing it, and I went on to actually the TV commercials. And, you know, in the film business, you're either in one venue or another, and it's very, very difficult to fluctuate between, let's say, documentaries and TV commercials and or like feature films. As an overt example, Steven Spielberg has a cameraman that he's working with now since Schindler's List, and his name is Gamush Kaminski, and Kaminski wouldn't be doing a documentary or an interview, you know, with Martin Luther King. That's that kind of thing is at the very height of the motion picture world. It's what everybody dreams about doing, but very few have the talent to do that. It's very few people can have the talent to do what Spielberg does, you know, making major motion picture. It's a tremendous talent that nobody's pretty knows much about, but it's something to think about. But anyway, I'm just giving you an overt example of the differences in the different venues. Like there's news work that's considered at the low end of motion picture work. You know, like if you're a news cameraman for a local TV station, that's the sort of the low end in terms of talent. And then it goes all the way up to the feature film area.
Okay, I want to get back to the movie itself.
Yeah.
What is the title of the movie?
Martin Luther King Jr., A Personal Portrait. That's the full title of the film. And it's never been seen, and I don't know what Arnold did with it or how he did it or if he ran out of money, but 40 years went by, and I had never seen it. So one day I was sitting home and wonder what happened to that film. I was just curious, and so I began to track down his daughter because I knew he died. Arnold died in 1997. So I tracked down his daughter, and she had never seen the film either. But her father donated all of his interviews that I mentioned earlier, mostly on audio tape. He donated them and to the Peabody Collection and Georgia University. And so I called this number, and I asked them if they had anything in Arnold's repertoire that was about Martin Luther King. So they looked it up, and they said, yes, we do have a film here. It's called, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., A Personal Portrait. I said, my goodness, well, I was the director of that film. And they said, are you still alive? So anyway, they had they were very generous to me. They sent me a courtesy copy, a DVD, because nothing much is available now. It's all that original footage has been sent out to California to be preserved. And so I got this DVD, and it was the first time I've ever seen the thing put together. And it was edited, and it had titles on it and everything. So I began to show it around to my personal friends, one of which was Raymond Taylor, who was a member of the Queens College Alumni Association. And so he went back and talked to a few of the important people at the college about the film, and they were very curious, so they actually called me in so they could see the film to make sure that it would fit in with their programming. And they loved it, and they booked me for the February 4th, which is where I met you at that showing, and that's how that came about.
Well, let's go into the movie itself not to say to give away the plot. I mean, people generally know, you know, the things that go on, but what were the topics, the main topics that were talked about?
Well, the first thing that up on the film is they got into the subject of the Vietnam War, and Dr. King knew a lot of historical detail about Vietnam, reaching back into the 40s, and how they were always seeking self-determination, and they really weren't interested in joining anything related to China, communist China. And the country was never unified in 3,000 years. It was sort of like Yugoslavia was, you know, under Marshal Tito, where they had the Christians and the Muslims who hated each other, but he made sure they kept separate and didn't kill each other, and there was no ethnic cleansing. And just as an example, but in Vietnam, that country was never unified, but for some reason our State Department felt that we should become involved there because I guess they were afraid of communist expansion. But anyway, Dr. King knew all about that, and he explained how the Viet Cong never even existed. I don't know whether everybody knows who the Viet Cong were, but there was sort of an armed force that was spontaneously developed to fight off the American invasion, and before that it was the French. The French had control over that area. It was one of their colonies. And we supported the French in their efforts to keep it that way, in the early 50s. And so Dr. King knew all about that, and that was one of the things that he wasn't attracted to. He thought it was a disaster in every way. And when the war started, what happened was that there was a lot of government money that was being used to try to help the poor people, try to help education in America, especially in the black communities. And Dr. King noticed that a lot of that money was being taken away and used to buy bombs. When we dropped four times as many tons of bombs in Vietnam than we did in all of World War II. So it became just barbaric, and so that was one of the subjects they talked about. And they talked about him being away so much, and how he regretted that because it was there was no way he could avoid being away with the work that he was doing all over the country, making hundreds and thousands of speeches, you know, about civil rights and eventually what happened was that I think he embarrassed a lot of lawmakers because in 1964 President Johnson called him to the White House to witness his signing of the Civil Rights Act, and I showed pictures of that, which was quite amazing because it was about 8 years before that the house was bombed in Montgomery, Alabama. So it was a fascinating eight-year period of really strenuous work on King's part to be away from his house like 25 days out of every month. He was not home. He was in some city making speeches. So there he was standing next to the president at the signing. And then the president turned to Martin Luther King right after the signing and shook his hand because he was the primary motive for getting the Civil Rights Act done, you know, for everybody who had a half a brain in this country. I mean, you would think that the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence would be enough for anyone to realize that it was not only for whites, it was for everybody. So they talked a lot about that. And then, of course, the penultimate question that Arnold asked him was about his possible assassination. So he went into a long discussion about how he felt about some people felt that to make a political statement, they would like self-immolate. You know, they would pour gas on themselves and light the match. And he explained that that wasn't his idea of a proper gesture.
Right.
And that, however, if he was killed by doing the work he's doing, he would think that that might have redemptive value, and he understood that very well and wouldn't mind giving his life under those conditions. And that's actually how the film ended.
Now, I just want to ask you a question. Now, do you know the date of when you were actually filming this?
Yes. I don't know the exact date, but it was December of 65. I would say probably in the middle of the month.
Okay, and I'm just because I'm looking to see, like, in terms of, and he, I don't have in front of me, so his assassination was when?
The assassination took place on April 4th, 1968. So about two and a quarter years after we were with him, he was dead.
Okay, so in other words, yeah.
The assassination occurred in Memphis, Tennessee, where he went to help out the sanitation workers in Memphis were having a strike for better wages and better working conditions. And so they asked him to show up there, and which he did. And the night before, he made that famous speech called "I've Been to the Mountaintop," and the next day he was dead. He was assassinated. But that's a very interesting part of what happened that day. He was not really staying at the Lorraine Motel. I don't think anybody knows this because the press was really muffled during that. There was actually a trial in 1999. Well, I'll get into that in a minute. But the King assassination was very, very suspect from the beginning because of the detail. They thought that James Earl Ray did it from a bathroom window. We didn't get into this, by the way, in the film. But I'm just giving you a sidelight.
Yeah.
What happened on April 4th, 68. but if you want to backtrack into the film, I can talk to you about Coretta. We got Coretta on camera, and she spoke about how she was very reluctant to get involved with a minister because she thought that they were the ministers were all wearing dark black suits, and many of them were very pious, and she was very skeptical about getting involved with a minister. But after she met Martin, she saw that he was a genuine human being and a kind, generous person, and so that's how they got together. But initially, it was like not so certain. And then she talked about the house was bombed, and her parents came immediately, and Martin's parents came immediately, and they were all discussing what to do. And she said, well, her father wanted her to leave immediately and take the baby and come back and live with him. And she said, no, Dad, I'm gonna stay with Martin. And that's how that happened. They stayed together through that, and it made them more determined than ever. Now, she was as committed as he was to civil rights and race and against racism. So they both were, like I called them, the power couple. It didn't matter what was going on in their personal lives. Like, in other words, what I've been led to believe and told is that when he'd be away for 25 days out of the month, she never confronted him, saying, like, what were you doing Saturday night, you know, that kind of thing. That never came up between them, so that they just cruised on with their devotion to the movement, and that's how they were able to stay together and fight together. And like I explained, that eight-year period from the time the house was bombed to him witnessing the signing of the Civil Rights Act was quite an amazing period of time for them both, because it was a question of total dedication and then raising a family at the same time. So Coretta was really a soldier, which Dr. King expressed in the film. She was saying that, well, when they had breakfast the next day after the bombing, Reverend King said, I don't know what I would have done without you, Coretta. You're a real soldier. And they continued to be real soldiers for the whole rest of that movement.
Can you tell us about this thing with Funtown?
Yeah, the Funtown was interesting because Funtown was a little amusement park in Atlanta, which was not open to black children. So it was evidently on their way to the airport, which he made so many trips to. And the children would often be in the car, and they would say, Daddy, why can't I go to Funtown? So they try to evade that. They talk about that in the film, and they try to evade explaining that. Or eventually they had to explain that, well, black children aren't allowed there, and that's why Daddy is working so hard to get that opened up so that, you know, their children could play there. So at one time he was put in jail I forget where, Albany, Georgia. He was put in jail, and the kids were wondering, why is Daddy in jail? So Coretta explained to the children that Daddy was in jail to try to help opening up, civil rights so that black children could play in Funtown. So one of the daughters then said that, well, you tell Daddy to stay in jail until we can play in Funtown. So that was all in the film. It was kind of a light moment in that sense, you know, with a young kid made up that idea that, well, he should stay in jail until we can play there.
Well,
Yeah, it was a light moment in the film.
The one light moment in the film was probably, well, a sort of mistake in the background, an unplanned thing in the background that everybody was giggling about. Do you realize what that was?
No, tell me about that.
Oh, because all this, see, every once in a while there was this like a sort of a screen door, in the back that would, like, somebody would try to open up, like one of the kids was, I guess, they were trying to see what was going on. And
it was a louver door that opened.
And it opened a little, but at one point it opened up, and I guess it was one of the kids, and you saw the kid, and you saw somebody taking the kid away and closing
the
door.
Right, yeah, because, you know, everybody had to keep quiet when we were filming because, you know, it's sound. And so that was a big disturbance to their family, especially with young children like that. So that, you see, I was on camera. I saw that happen. Now, usually you would stop the camera and you get that thing back, you know, where the louver doors closed and start again. But I just kept running because I thought it was amusing.
Oh,
and I'm
yeah,
glad I did. I'm glad I did that. So you reacted to it, and then so did the audience. It was a nice human touch.
Yeah, it's a human touch, and it also shows that this is not a take one, take five kind of movie.
Right. Yeah, that's why. I'm on the camera, and generally I would cut the camera, or anyone would cut the camera, because that was like a defect, you know, especially with sort of a solemn interview with a major figure who just won the Nobel Peace Prize. You would generally, you know, stop the camera and fix things and then start it up again from a different angle, maybe. An interesting thing, Oliver Stone, the famous director, invited me for lunch in November, and I met him and we spent 3 hours together. And one of the things he said was that, gee, well, I wonder why it would have been so much better if Dr. King had his jacket off, you know, was in his shirt sleeves. But that during that era, that's the way interviews went. You know, he was also a minister, so you know that kind of thing did not, from Dr. King's point of view, he wanted to appear sort of, you know, like official, like he's a minister. And he just won a Nobel Peace Prize. But Oliver was right. It would have been even more charming if he was in his shirt sleeves, right? But those things weren't happening in the 60s. It was sort of more formal. Like I did another film called Hunger in America a little bit later in 1967. I did a CBS Network presentation picture called Hunger in America.
Mm-hmm.
And the interviewer did the same thing. He would wear a Brooks Brothers suit with a shirt and tie, going into some poor Mexican woman's home, interviewing her, and it was just, I just begged him to take off his tie, but they wouldn't do it. Anyway, it was the same kind of syndrome. So Oliver was right, and he was, I don't know whether you know this, but he was hired to do a major motion picture script about Martin Luther King's life. And he had been working on it, and when I met him in November, I got the feeling that he was going to walk, which means that he was going to quit, because he was having a lot of trouble with the ideas that he wanted to put into the script. The King family had control over the content, and the King family wanted Dr. King to be portrayed as a saint, and that's really not what the reality was. So poor Oliver, after spending, you know, months and months writing the script, and he's very good at it, he had to walk away because, and that's just a sidelight. But anyway, you're right. It was a charming moment when the louver door opened accidentally.
And how also when one of the sons came in and sat on his lap?
Yeah.
Was that scripted or he just popped in?
That was spontaneous, yeah. Because it's hard to keep kids at that age, you know, corralled in some back room. And
mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was a nice, charming moment as well.
Yeah, that too. So you were commenting something about the assassination before.
Yeah. See, now, I've wherever I go and show this film, and then during the questions and answers after the film, no audience that I've ever been at so far had known that the King family sued the government in 1999 in Memphis for complicity in the assassination. And this had to be done in the civil court because the criminal court case was settled by James Earl Ray. When they brought James Earl Ray back to America, they found him at the London airport. And he was, you know, the alleged killer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when they brought him back, he said, I didn't do it. I want a trial. So he had no money for a lawyer, so they gave him a government lawyer. And the government lawyer said, if you sign this confession that you did it, it'll guarantee you a trial. And so James Earl Ray said, no, no kidding. Okay, I'll sign it. So he signed a confession that he did it, and they put him in jail. And after 2 weeks, he said, no, I don't. I didn't mean that. You know, I didn't do it. I want to rescind that confession. And the judge says, sorry, you did it, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, in America, there's two types of court, the criminal court and the civil court. So the King family had no choice but to go to the civil court to file a suit against the government for complicity in the assassination. So it took the jury less than 2 hours to come up with the verdict. And nobody knows the trial even existed because nobody was in the courtroom except one writer named James Douglas, who wrote a book about it, and then some woman reporter from Portugal. So the main media was not in the courtroom, and so nobody knew that the trial. It wasn't the O.J. Simpson trial that was the trial of the century. It was the Martin Luther King trial in Memphis in 1999, and you can go to your computer and just put in MLK versus U.S. government. That's all you need to do, and it's hiding in plain sight, all the detail. And the detail is endless in terms of circumstantial evidence and all that, but also hard evidence. Like the FBI was trying to prove that James Earl Ray's gun was the shooting gun. And the FBI sent that gun to three different laboratories that they trusted, and none of the laboratories could confirm that the bullet from James Earl Ray's gun was the bullet that killed King. I mean, that's such an overt, obvious example of how mistaken they were to convict Ray or to accept his confession. You understand? That's just
right.
One element of that kind of evidence is very powerful, but they couldn't connect James Earl Ray's gun with the bullet that they recovered from King's body, right?
Right.
Okay. Another thing is that when King went to Memphis, he was staying at the Holiday Inn, so someone snuck into their group and said, hey, why don't you stay at a motel that's owned by a black owner? So they said, well, okay. So they changed it to move him to the Lorraine Motel, which was under black ownership. So that's how he got to the Lorraine Motel. It was actually a conspiracy. And when somebody got to the clerk at the Lorraine Motel, and they said, Dr. King loves to look at swimming pools. Can you imagine? So that when they came over to the Lorraine, they put him in a back room up there on that balcony, which was completely exposed to what they wanted to be exposed. Then another detail is that somebody from the Defense Department sent some people over to the firehouse, which was right near the Lorraine Motel. And they asked if the fire department, if they could go up on the roof and look it over for some photographic needs that they had, that kind of thing. But that's all circumstantial. Another thing that was circumstantial is that during that time, there were 10 Army sharpshooters in Memphis. All right? Now, all of that, see, a conspiracy is set up like that, so you can't grab somebody by the neck and say, you did it. You know, there's so much circumstantial evidence that was revealed. For instance, there was always the police department in Memphis had a group of five black detectives who were always assigned to King when he came to town to protect him, and the five of those guys were told to stay home.
Oh.
On that day. And also what happened recently was that a new photograph turned up that showed that from the bathroom window that James Earl Ray was alleged to have used to shoot from, a picture showed up where the tree blocked the whole vision of that balcony that Dr. King stood on. So it goes on and on. But in any case, the King family, they only sued for $100 in the civil court, and they won. And the government admitted that two of their agencies were complicit in the assassination. Now, none of that has reached the public perception. And one overt example to me personally is that every year CNN plays a one-hour documentary about the assassination, continuing to show that James Earl Ray was the guy who did it.
No.
And it's so pathetic because it just shows you how the government can control the media.
Oh, sure. But why was he chosen? I mean, why James Earl Ray?
Well, because he happened to be staying at that rooming house, and in a conspiracy where some very sophisticated people are involved to plan such a thing, they knew who he was, and it's sort of similar to the JFK assassination where they got Lee Harvey Oswald,
right? Yeah,
to be the fall guy. But see, when a conspiracy occurs, that's the way it occurs, where they find a fall guy, and they nail him. They put him in a position where he's going to be nailed, and that clears everything from the conspirator's point of view.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, you see, the thing is, Dr. King made a speech at Riverside Church in 1967, where he described America as the largest purveyor of violence in the world, and that was when LBJ was fighting to keep the war going. He didn't want to give up because, you know, now with the Freedom of Information Act, you can hear all the phone conversations that the president had, and there's one that he's talking to Governor Smathers of, I think, of Florida, where he's explaining that if they give up and pull out, they'll be seen as weaklings. We'll be seen as weaklings in the world. And so, therefore, Johnson was reluctant to pull out, even though he was very uncomfortable with what was going on. And they invented what they call the Tompkins Gulf Resolution. Do you remember that?
No.
Where they invented a situation where a Vietnamese gunboat fired on one of our ships. It's called the Tompkins Gulf Resolution. And that enabled them to have justification for the war to continue. You see how those things work?
Right.
Yeah. So that's another sidelight that I'm just giving you here. But we could go on and on. Now, Oliver Stone has written a book which was released in 2012. It's called The Untold Story, The Untold History of the United States. And I urge everyone to get a copy of that book because it describes in detail that was gotten from genuine sources. You know, everything is indexed in the back of the book, so it's not Oliver Stone making up stories. Everything can be validated by looking up the records that do exist. You understand?
Was this, did they show this on TV or talk about this on TV?
Yes,
he
sure did. And,
okay, I sort of remember something.
I mean, at the showing on Tuesday night at the Queen's College, I mentioned that book, but you could see the glazed eyes of the audience. They had no idea about the book, and they're not likely to go and buy it. But it covers the history of America from 1990 right up to Obama. And it's not a very pretty picture of American foreign policy. And it's really, I couldn't put the book down. It's like so full of chapter and verse, you know, with the detail, what people actually said, things like that. It took 5 years of research to do the book, you know, and it's just, you know, a lot of people will probably read it and not want to accept it, that America was so imperialistic, especially in South America. The CIA was involved with all kinds of really dirty tricks in preventing any kind of communist leader from becoming powerful and being elected. And that's one of the reasons why Cuba was so isolated by America, because they were communists. There's, you know, the people in the State Department, they had an obsession and a fear, a deep-seated fear of communism in the Western Hemisphere. But all of that is a sidetrack to what we're talking about. We're talking about Dr. King. But
right.
Oliver Stone's film, unfortunately, will never be seen, and it would have been a much more accurate picture of the real Dr. King.
So, he made this film, and it...
He did not make it. He wrote the script.
Oh, he wrote the script.
Yeah, and the script was turned down, and that's what happened there, so it'll never be seen. But Dr. King, Oliver is thinking that the film that eventually may be made is going to be like a homogenized version. You know
yes.
what I'm saying? Where someone will be made into a saint. And Dr. King was never a saint.
Yeah.
You understand? He was a real person who was trying to do a real job about overt conditions in America. Right? Like I'm saying, if you look at the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, you'd have to be a moron not to realize that you've got to deal with this, with the black people in America, because they're citizens, and what are you going to do, put them in jail? You understand? I mean,
right.
What was going on in terms of the black life in the South especially was that they were restricted to just about every public venue. Like, you couldn't even take a drink of water because you had a special fountain that was for blacks only. I mean, they were
right.
treated like subhuman beings. And that's not what America was all about, right?
That's right.
So you'd have to be a moron to have the Civil Rights Act written up and signed to keep you on the straight path. You understand? It was such an unnecessary thing to do, but it had to be done because so many people were obtuse or just too racist to be able to... have a country that meant something. You can't have a country where you have isolated a complete race within your, you know, citizens of your country completely denied any kind of dignity.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. King and Coretta King were fighting against that. And what happened was we in America... We can't stand to have the church and the state mingle and be influencing each other. There's a definite separation of church and state.
But it's due anyway.
He was okay with the civil rights
right.
Movement that he was involved in, but like I explained, at that speech he made at the Riverside Church in 67, where he portrayed America as the largest purveyor of violence in the world, that's when he began the severe left turn, so to speak, and he touched the third rail. And what he did was he disturbed all of the power structure in America, that is the military-industrial complex, the State Department, the president. Everybody was fighting the Vietnam War, and there was a draft going on during that time, where every young man was drafted. Now at this time during our Middle East problems, there's no draft, right? It's all volunteer
right.
army.
Right.
So what happened during the Vietnam War? A lot of people were tearing up their draft cards and moving to Canada to avoid the absurdity of fighting, going 7,000 miles away and fighting the Vietnamese people who did nothing to us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. King was fighting. What really disturbed him was that a lot of the young black men were being drafted in the army to go and shoot yellow people for no particular reason. And at home, they couldn't even take a drink at a public fountain or stay at a hotel, or they had to be in the back of the bus. So that would that was infuriating to King and to anybody, a lot of other people as well. But you can see what was going on there. It was a very dramatic, a very dramatic part of our history. I mean, the Civil Rights Act did help because it then made a federal law that it was like forbidden to have a segregated school, or you know, it eliminated in straight, reasonable, simple-minded terms the things that you had to do to not be racist, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, theoretically, you would think, well, who would need that when we've got the Bill of Rights, right?
Right, that's correct.
So they were talking about that, and it was sort of a fascinating period. But even now, as we speak, there's a tremendous amount of racism going on in America. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Yeah, well, now the Bill of Rights is being challenged in terms of same-sex couples getting married.
Right, yeah, that's another issue. Right.
So
there's a lot of prejudice, and prejudice exists everywhere in the world, and it's especially apparent in the Middle East. I mean, you have in Iraq, you had the Sunnis and the Shias and the Kurds. They hated each other for 3,000 years, and they would cut your ears off if you weren't part of them, right? And Saddam Hussein was a dictator, but he was similar to Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia. You know, he kept everybody in line and prevented them from the kind of like ethnic cleansing that went on, where the Muslims would kill all the Christians just because they were Christians. And even among the Muslims, they would kill each other if just for slight differences in their approach to their religion. You see it every day in the paper. Suicide bombers, they're bombing each other because of slight differences in their religion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
well, I want to get back to the movie on one question I had is your personal experience about being there and doing this.
Yes, it's like I explained at the presentation. You know, from my point of view, being the cameraman and director, there's a lot of pressure, especially when you're a freelancer. In other words, every job you do has to be sort of like perfect, and you have nowhere to hide. In other words, the framing, the lighting, the whole visualization is your responsibility, and you can't hide from it because when it's shown up on the screen, it's either there or it isn't there. And when you have the what I call the suits, the executive producers up in New York, when they look at the footage, you either die or you survive based on what the stuff looks like, right?
Right.
Like if you're an assistant director, you have plenty of room to hide, right? Because there's nothing that you have done that shows up on the screen in vivid terms. So anyway, I loved living my whole adult life, what I call living on the edge. But getting back to your point, when I approached that assignment, I was honored to be selected. Yes, that's true. But once you get in the door of Martin Luther King's living room, you're totally focused on serious matters of execution in terms of lighting, where do we shoot it, how do we shoot it, when do you zoom in, when do you zoom out. All those things are so critical to the eventual emotional. It's all about creating emotion. Motion picture work is all about creating emotion, and that's done through lighting, choice of image size, when do you zoom, So, you know, it was interesting to meet him after he won the Nobel Peace Prize. I didn't know what to expect, but what we got, what I felt and learned and lived through was this wonderful man who was so humble after such major events, like he explained it as a mountaintop experience, right, to win the Nobel Prize. So you would expect like a guy who would be a little bit pompous or a little bit reserved or whatever, but it was completely the opposite. He was so natural and generous with his time and very understanding. Like when if I told him that we have to do that again and I'm going to do a close-up, that sort of thing. He was very, very sophisticated about the media, how the camera is used. So I was so calmed by being in his presence. He was he had such magic about him. He was very, it's just hard to explain, but he was so easy to be with, considering his stature.
Mm. Well, that's right. So was this one of the most outstanding experiences for you in terms of who you interviewed, or so to speak, not interviewed, who you've filmed?
Yeah, I mean, I've done so many interviews, right, with Adlai Stevenson and Governor Avril Harriman and all kinds of people like that who were running for office. And this was a highlight because of the way of King's personality. He was so natural. But as you're asking, through a long career that I've been blessed to have, which were the most interesting events that I was around. And well, one of them was that I was the man that shot the JFK's inaugural address. Now, that was really a major moment and considered one of the most powerful speeches of the 20th century. And I was responsible for filming that. That was one highlight. Another highlight was really special. It was like I was called to do some work with Betty Davis in New York City. And I filmed her doing a few things coming out of the Plaza Hotel and that sort of thing. And she asked me to have dinner with her. So that was like, are you kidding me? So I spent 2 hours having dinner with Betty Davis at the Playbill restaurant in Manhattan. And we were sitting thigh to thigh for 2 hours. And then she said, would you like to get back to the Plaza with me and have a drink? So I said, well, Betty, I told my wife I'd be home about 10. So she said, oh, I'm so sorry. but I've been under psychiatric observation ever since.
let me also ask, in terms of the movie, will this be shown again, and if so, where?
I'm showing it next Tuesday at the Gateway Community College in New Haven, Connecticut. And then on the 27th, I'm showing it at Santa Monica College in California. But it will never be televised. And so it's just a question of people finding out about it. And I do have an agent, and we'll see what he can do. But that's the only way it's going to be seen. Like I told you in the beginning, this all the footage that I shot has been sent out to be preserved and taken off the I shot it in 16 millimeter negative film, which is celluloid with the emulsion on it.
Right.
After 40 years or so, that stuff deteriorates. And so now it's out there being what they call digitized.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a long time to do it, and it's not in any way ready yet to be sent back. And they asked me if I would maybe write a treatment for a different version. Because, you see, I haven't seen all the footage. I just saw what you saw, the edited version that Mr. Michaelis made. But I don't know what he left out. As
Right.
A simple example, Well, as a simple example, in our film that we saw Tuesday, when Coretta talks about their home being bombed, there's no picture of the bombed house in the film. And that's why I showed the still picture before the film. Do you remember that?
Right.
I showed their home before and after it was bombed. Simple things like that could improve the film quite a bit. As you know, as she's speaking about the bombing, we could show a still picture of the house. Right.
Right.
It would add so much more power and drama to the discussion that she's talking about, the detail.
Mm-hmm. But, I wanted to share with you. I was in when I was in Kansas, outside of Wichita, I went to a fault mines, and they have a museum. Part of this, I don't know that you get to see it, but because it was before the museum was open, that I got to see this, and there's this huge area where things are preserved. In other words, like Warner Brothers has their movies there.
Uh-huh.
In other words, that was another way of preserving the films.
Oh, yes.
And
yeah.
being in a salt mine.
Yeah. Well, anyway, see, the film that we saw can be made more powerful by re-editing it, you know?
Yeah.
And keeping the basic material that you saw, because that's really essential. It's what I call the basic Martin Luther King philosophy. He talked about all his main philosophies. And what was fascinating, every time I see it, I learn more. But everything he said that you saw in that film, which was done 50 years, half a century ago, can be applicable today. It makes total sense for today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he talked about war as a crude chisel to get to peace.
Right.
I mean, just that alone is like, of course, you know. This is all madness, what we've been through in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's all madness, and it's to try to homogenize cultures that have been killing each other for 3,000 years, and in Afghanistan, I mean, every town is ruled by a separate warlord, and you need to pay them money if you want to pass through, so to speak, right? We spent billions on money to try to build highways in Afghanistan. And in order to build a highway, every time you go through, the contractor, the corruption is so... Afghanistan is listed as the most corrupt country in the world, right? Everybody wants to be paid. You know, anybody who has any kind of authority, to get past them, you have to give them money. I mean, it's so pathetic. And we've spent billions and billions... And half the people are illiterate, and 40% of them are on opium, and we're trying to buy them uniforms and try to you know, bring order to a country that's completely splintered by local warlords, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that's a whole other subject. We could talk for hours on that.
Yeah. Can I just ask you? You don't have a website that people can go to?
No, not yet, no. I guess I should do that, because there's, you know, if you want to get back to discussion about highlights of the career, there are so many, I don't know where to begin, except...
Right now, there's 1 minute left to the end of the show.
Oh, okay. So, anyway, it was a pleasure to meet you, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to explain certain things about the film. And I'm the guy to see if you want to, you know, if some institution wants to see this film, they can get in touch with me at 631-725-2982.
Okay.
And life will go on.
Okay.
And it was a pleasure talking with you.
Same here.
And
have
nice
a
to
great
meet.
Day.
Okay, thanks so much.
Bye.
Okay, bye for now.
Okay, and we will end the show right now. Have a good day, good afternoon, evening, or however you're watching it.